This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
This story discusses incidents of self-harm. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are advised that this episode contains the names of people who have died. If you or anyone you know is struggling, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14, Beyond Blue, or 1300 22 46 36, or 13 Yarn on 13 92 76.
All over it.
Hello, I'm Alicia.
And I'm Pam.
And we're all over it, so you don't have to be. The news, that is.
This is your weekly explainer covering the important local, national and international headlines and what they mean for you. Yes, you. If you're listening to this, you might be an RTRFM listener. Maybe you're a Borloo Perth local.
You might be my dad with his friends.
Well, mixing it up this week. My
man, both
dad.
Listening.
News can feel far-reaching, but we're going to explain what you need to know and why it matters.
On this episode, another child dies in custody in WA, marking the second death of a child within the state's youth detention system in less than a year.
Now, if you followed our launch, you might have noticed that we're changing the format slightly. We'll still be in your ears weekly, but with just one story, so we can give you all that you need to know, instead of limiting it. Before we get into this week's story, Alicia, what's your wormhole of the week?
I organise a quiz every week, so I have to be across like kind of vague headlines, rogue headlines sometimes. And one of the headlines that I got across this week was that a beluga whale had been found passed away in one of the in Norway. Yes, very sad. His name was Hvladimir.
Sorry, what?
His name was Hvladimir.
Hvladimir.
Indeed, indeed.
Okay.
And maybe, I don't know if that's the greatest pronunciation, but that's how the headline I read said. My main question was like, okay, why am I reading about this?
Yeah.
And that is how I found out about the accusations levelled at this beluga whale.
What do you mean, accusations at a whale?
Oh, yeah, big time.
The whale has...
Well, there's been some whale news recently. I don't know if you're across the whale news. There is, like, a lot of stuff about, like, the whales are getting quite aggressive. There's, like, different patterns going on. So that's what I assumed it was. This one is a little bit different because he was actually accused of being a spy. Crazy. He was accused of Russian espionage. He was.
No.
He was an agent, allegedly. However, if you Google a pic of him, he's wearing a little harness with Russian writing on the side. And
he's
it does
not wearing a little
fit
harness.
A spot for like a little GoPro camera and stuff as well. So he's...
They put a harness on the... Look, producer Danny is also chuckling in the background.
Yeah, and she is looking at pictures of him.
And she's looking up pictures, and now we're looking at pictures
Isn't he brilliant?
Oh, my God, Hvladimir. Oh, he's quite cute, actually.
He's so cute. He's also so friendly. So this was kind of his gig, was that he was so friendly, and he would come up to all the boats, and he would, like, they would give him a little pat, and he'd, like, have a little chat with them. But then he also had, like, a little camera, and he'd be scoping out the scene. Genius, right? From the seas?
He is not.
Okay, so that was the start of the wormhole.
Oh, no.
What I fell down was, is this normal? Like, are people using marine animals as spies? Yes is the answer.
No, they're not.
They are. Using...
There is a whole ring of spies. Dolphins?
Dolphins are doing it. Sea lions
are
doing it.
Dolphins are sneaky. They are. Dolphins are so sneaky.
And they're clever. But the things they're doing are, like, maybe more than what I'm capable of. They're crazy. They're like holding ropes underwater for them to organise the cords when they're going into things.
How are they communicating with them? Are they on a payroll? Do you think that they have like sick leave and
stuff?
They
have super? Are they okay? They're like sniffing out little mines. They're doing espionage stuff. They're running interference between boats. Like they're fully...
What do you mean they're running interference?
They're getting in the way. They're arcing up when they need to.
This is hilarious. Are these like trained dolphins? I'm so interested in this wormhole.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. That is going to be my wormhole for the next week,
please.
I reckon.
And if anyone can find out if Australia is doing this, I need to know because I feel like we should be.
We'll text in.
Yeah. Let me know.
Email the studio. Email RTR, RTRFM.
It's me, Alicia. I've got some ideas for you.
Says DM us on Instagram. I want to know if there's Australian marine mammals or even Australian animals just being spies.
Yeah, genius.
All right, let's get into today's story.
Second teenager dies by suicide in WA Youth Detention Centre. So that one's from SBS. But it is also important to note that as of Monday, a second person, a man at Hakea Prison in Perth South East, has also passed away in WA detention.
This is pretty agonising news, especially as it follows the death of 16-year-old Yamaji youth Cleveland Dodd last year. He was found unresponsive in a cell at Casuarina Prison's infamous Unit 18 in the early hours of October 12. He died 8 days later in hospital.
There's currently an ongoing investigation and inquiry into that incident, but we'll have a bit more of a chat about that later.
Let's go over the facts as of September 5, when we're recording this podcast. I want to know what's happening with this story. Get us across it. Let's learn about what's going on here.
Absolutely. So last week, a 17-year-old boy, who obviously we can't identify for legal reasons, died by self-harm in his cell at WA's Bankshire Hill Detention Centre, and his death was announced last Friday by our Premier, Roger Cook. At the press conference, Corrective Service Minister Brad Royce said the teenager had arrived in the detention centres 2 days prior to his death and was out of his cell for most of the afternoon prior. He also said that he arrived in an intoxicated state and had potentially been taking illicit drugs. We want to stress that this language, it's a very particular framing.
Yeah, it's kind of problematic language.
Yeah.
It feels a little victim-blamey almost.
I think it feels like they're trying to explain and frame their position, and I think that that is tough to hear because it leaves a lot of questions. But yeah, I would agree with you there. But this is a language our leaders are still evoking, really, to discuss the death of people. So it's important that we have these conversations. And also important that we acknowledge that this is an issue which disproportionately impacts Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So very important how we discuss this and that we do make sure that this is a visible issue that we're talking about.
Yeah, sure.
In this statement, Royce also said that the youth was subsequently placed at the at-risk management system, which means that he would be closely monitored. He then details the night of his death. He said staff checked on the young man over the course of the evening 10 times, and on the 11th occasion they found him unresponsive in his cell. It was also noted that staff body-worn cameras and radios were assessed following the incident, and a review determined the staff response was adequate.
This is pretty confronting to hear about, and it does seem like this story unfolded really quickly. What do we know about the young man prior to his admission to Bankshire Hill?
I think this is kind of a really important point because this is an opportunity to talk about an experience of many people that go through our incarceration systems here in WA. So for this particular young man, we know from reports that he had previously been in out-of-home care, and this wasn't his first contact with the system. Out-of-home care is an arrangement for children outside their own family homes, including after-hours placements, district care, foster care, group homes and transitional high-needs care. This was facilitated by Plan and Grow, which is one of WA's few out-of-home care providers that focus on children with complex needs in juvenile justice. It's so crucial. I think if you haven't had a lot of contact with the youth sector, which is something that I have worked in and, you know, I'm incredibly passionate about, to understand the real pivotal role of agencies and different organisations and groups and community organisations like Plan and Grow.
Right.
That can be seen as early intervention or interventionary or preventative, and really are places for rehabilitation in the community or just taking care of people. I think that we're lucky to have so many fantastic organisations that really are focused around rehabilitation and really looking after people.
Have Plan and Grow and their position in this story, and from what we know about their involvement with this sort of situation, has that taken up any space in the reporting of this story? Is that mentioned very much, the sort of background of this person?
It was reported recently because we did have some representatives of Plan and Grow talk about the fact that they still wanted him to be in their care. And as with many people, anyone that's worked in nonprofit or kind of the community sector, we know that funding is tough for a lot of organisations. We don't have the space, we don't have the facilities for a lot of people. So I think that they were kind of calling for a renewed focus, energy and kind of investment in organisations such as this so that we can keep people
in spaces that help them thrive. And that's what Plan and Grow said with this young man particularly, is that he was thriving in their program.
Yeah.
And that there might have been a different outcome if he had access to continue within the program, which
right.
is pretty tough to hear.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about trauma-informed care and think about the kind of care that's going on for folks with complex needs in juvenile justice. Following the death, what have we learned? What do we know? What's been said about this in the media?
Yeah, so there's been quite a bit of conversation, which is exciting to see conversation happening, but also pretty confronting as well. Dana Levitt, who is a Human Rights Watch spokesperson and lawyer, who is representing a number of children in a class action lawsuit against the WA government over treatment in these facilities. She actually revealed that the young boy had been repeatedly detained since the age of 11. He also had a disability. And he'd also contacted them to be involved in that class action lawsuit. Tragically, children who are held in Bankshire Hill, which is particularly where this young person was, can be held there because they have nowhere else to go. That's actually not uncommon. Sometimes it's not because they've committed a crime or they're going through those processes. It's actually because there's nowhere else for them to be.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. It's I think that we'd all like to think that that's the exception to the rule, but it's not uncommon if they can't find a place for the young people to go that they do need to be.
Yeah.
In a facility.
So sometimes, so what you're saying is sometimes it's not the most appropriate solution or not the most reasonable action, but it is sometimes the one that is taken because it's the only option.
That's, well, it's seen as the only option because we haven't created other options. But I think it's an important kind of, you can take a second to reflect on if you were 10 or 11 and you had nowhere else to go, like, if you have children, if you have family, friends, and they're 10 or 11 and they have nowhere else to go.
Would you like a prison to be the first port of call?
Do you feel like that's an appropriate kind of space for it to be? I think it's easy if you have no contact with these kind of organisations or if you have no contact with this area before. And I think everyone comes from different places and spaces as well. But if you just really reflect on 10 years old and you're a kid, like, that's not your own fault if you don't have somewhere to go. So
it's really troubling that is the system that we have set up, is that is the decision making that happens and that's the process that gets followed. And that's what we're seeing with this story, is tragically this is an example of how this system isn't working, would you say?
Yeah, I went to a conversation with Buruz Bukhani a few months ago, who was an amazing Kurdish-Iranian journalist who was actually detained in Manus Island from 2013 to 2017. And he speaks a lot about detention in Australia because he's experienced it firsthand. And I remember him saying something that really rocked me. He said, Australia started off as a penal colony, and we sometimes have a tendency here to continue to kind of compartmentalize our problems, like, instead of dealing with things that are going on in our society or dealing with the difficult conversations we need to have, we outsource them and put them in, we detain them, really, and we do it with our mental health system, we do it with our youth, we do it with our asylum seekers and refugees, we do it in a number of ways when we don't know how to deal with a complex problem. It's not uncommon here to lock them up. And I thought, that's a horrific thing to say. Please don't say that to us. Like, that's not a reflection of the WA and the Australia that I know. But then I was reflecting, I was thinking, what are we getting at by putting young people that are struggling in a prison? Like, it is an odd concept. So I think it's worth reflecting on, even if you think that this is an appropriate measure, why are we doing it, and how is this helping? Is this actually furthering it?
Yeah. If we get some background on this issue does go all the way back to colonisation. Can you talk to us a little bit about getting a clear picture and how we can start to understand the context that informs stories like this nowadays?
Yeah, big time. I think especially when we're in Australia, we have an Australian context. And if you are to talk to people outside of Australia around the way that we detain young people and the facilities that we have, people are pretty horrified a lot of the time. And I was really shocked to find that out. I was like, oh, isn't that how everyone's doing it? It turns out, no, that's not how most people do it. Even there are countries that we label as having human rights abuses, like the Taliban government in Afghanistan. Their criminal age of responsibility is 12. you know, like in Dubai, in China, like all these countries that we're constantly having these conversations about, their criminal age of responsibility is higher than ours. 12, sometimes even in these countries, 14, 15.
Yeah.
And yet here in Australia, it's 10. So it's worth locating us in the context, like a global context a little bit.
Absolutely.
And we can touch on that again. It's important, kind of the conversations here really started or kind of grew in the public eye in 2016. When ABC's investigative program Four Corners released a report into the Dondale Youth Detention Facility, sparking a royal commission into the protection and detention of children in the Northern Territory.
What were some of the recommendations or the things that came up as part of that investigative program and part of that inquiry?
Yep. So banning the use of tear gas and force or restraint being used to discipline children was one, which feels like a bit of a...
That was a recommendation, banning the use of tear gas against children.
Oh, I'm going to hold your hand when I tell you about the rest of this, girl.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, yep. Yes, we would like them to do that.
Yeah, for sure. So what else are they recommending?
They recommended introducing body-worn video cameras in youth detention centres.
That should definitely be happening.
Yes, and actually following that report, WA did introduce that and Banksia Hill did introduce that in 2016. And then they had a rollout maybe like a month or two ago of like updated cameras through Banksia Hill and Unit 18 as well. Prohibiting extendable periods in isolation over 24 hours or its use as a punishment.
Wow. Isolating children for over 24 hours. They were recommending that was prohibited, which would mean it wasn't currently prohibited.
Well, in the Northern Territory and in Queensland at the start of the year, we've seen a lot of reports about children being held in isolation for 23 hours a day for like 40 days at a time, extended periods of time. And I just can't even imagine being alone with my thoughts for 10 minutes. but for a period of 23 hours a day and then for the 1 hour you're allowed out, it's still in isolation.
Right.
How is that benefiting anyone's like mental health?
Well, that is the question, right? How is it benefiting?
Yeah.
Why is that a decision that's been weighed? Why is that a consideration that's happening? Mm. Is this consideration a trauma-informed decision? Is this a decision that is considering the age of these people? And is it a decision that has been carried over as a practice from adult prisons and adult care rather than youth detention care that feels that it's been made by and for people that are, you know, experts or informed about youth care?
Yeah,
it's a really interesting one.
I think I'm going to be that annoying kid in the uni classes. I have to play devil's advocate.
This is what you're here for.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there is a conversation. I know many people that have worked in the corrective systems and they're amazing people and they want the best for the young people. And the same for our government. I think that they do want the best for our young people. I think that the line that they always say is, we don't have the resources, we don't have the facilities, these things take a long time, all of that stuff. Also, I guess there's an argument for a lot of these young people are like these are highly complex cases and that they need to be managed kind of individually to prevent any kind of altercations or anything happening. They just need to be managed individually. Like we're hearing they're checking on someone 10, 11 times. That's pretty frequent.
Mm.
But if that's your line, then why isn't it working? We've been having these conversations for a long time and it's really devastating to see what we're seeing at the moment. So.
Yeah. What was the last recommendation?
The last recommendation was increasing engagement with and involvement of Aboriginal organisations in child protection, youth justice and detention.
So what's happened since then?
The light has been well and truly on the issue and subsequent research has found that 89% of children and youth in Banksia Hill specifically have severe neurodevelopmental impairments and over one third, which is 36%, were found to be suffering with fetal alcohol syndrome disorder or FASD.
So Australia seems like it's really lagging in terms of youth justice. You mentioned what we're like in a global context, but specifically raising the age of criminal responsibility and facilitating programs that target the complex needs of people who find themselves in the system. What have we heard from advocacy bodies about this incident?
We've had the former boss of WA's Department of Justice break down on the stand when he was questioned about the state and the facilities and the treatment of young people at Banksia Hill and in custody. He did concede that the treatment of some juvenile detainees by the department was actually institutional abuse. So this is coming from the person that really knows it inside out, the person that was there. This is from the people that are working there as well, that this is these are abusive conditions. This isn't coming just from the organisations and the right. advocates that you'd expect, it's also coming from within.
Right.
A pretty gnarly one that I remember studying at university, which was that the UN torture prevention body has been pretty scathing of Australia's system in recent years. In October of 2022, we had signed up to this thing called the OPCAT, which is mm-hmm. basically an optional kind of treaty that you can stand up to say, we don't do torture over here. And okay. that's great.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And part of the condition of that is that they come out and they just check that you're being legit about that. There's like 60 countries that are signed up to it. We're one of them. They came out in October 2022. What they found very quickly was that there was a lot of hostility from the Australian institutions, particularly mental health care and our prison system.
Okay.
So much hostility in Queensland specifically and New South Wales that they were being barred from entering.
Whoa. Okay.
The facilities, which is like a condition of what we signed up for. They also accused the Australian media of running a smear campaign against them.
Right.
And they also said that the government officials were quite hostile and hectic as well.
So this is the UN torture prevention body yeah. accused the Australian government of running a media smear campaign.
Yes. And then they did something that was actually pretty huge. They terminated their visit.
Whoa.
So 15 years, 60 countries, 80 visits. This is the second time that they've ever terminated
Ooh,
a visit.
I just got goosebumps about that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The only other country that this has ever occurred in is Rwanda.
No way.
Yeah.
Oh, my. Oh, yeah. Okay. Wow.
So it's. I think that it's when we were talking before about like locating Australia within a context, Australia, we're saying that we are taking the appropriate measures and signing up and doing all the talking and the words that we're meant to do. And then when it comes down to it and people take a look inside, we yeah. either won't show them because we know the conditions
wow.
or when they do see it, because the UN did visit a few places, they found that they had, I'm going to like use the words that they used. They said that they had serious concerns about the behaviours that Australia's officials were exhibiting, and that might infer basically that there is torture degrading practices going on in
so the UN said no go. The UN said you're not behaving correctly, you're not doing the right thing in
yep.
in terms of youth detention, in terms of the criminal age of responsibility.
Yes.
The UN, the United Nations mm-hmm. said no go. They said bad behavior, they said stop it.
Yeah, they also spoke about something that you might have heard about in the news recently, which is the degrading practices that are used. So the solitary confinement of children that we've mentioned, the spit hoods, I don't know if you have seen that. There was also at the start of the year, there was the way that children are restrained. If you've it's pretty confrontational, so be careful yeah. with looking into that. But it is it's a degrading practice,
right?
And the strip searching as well. So there sure. was a number of
so they recommended that we ban those degrading practices. They recommended that we ban that we raise the age of criminal responsibility mm-hmm. to 14. Now that's an ongoing issue, and I remember seeing in the news and understanding that Victoria backflipped on their decision to raise the age last month.
Yeah, it was one of their election promises under Dan Andrews was to raise the criminal age of responsibility from 10 to 14. We do have, I think it's Jacinda Allen, so a different premier now, and she said, because it's going to be incremental because that's how policy works, she said that they're going to raise it to 12.
Hmm.
And then the expectation was that they'll raise it to 14, like they said. And she said, no, we're just going to raise it to 12. So, I mean, part of me is like, at least they've raised it to 12. Like, we could learn a little,
yeah.
we could learn a little over here.
Yeah, two steps forward, one step back.
Yeah, and disappointing because you made that commitment and, you know.
Yeah, right.
I also think it's worth mentioning that this is a conversation that Fiona Stanley really, really was emphasising in 2022. Paediatrician, she's the one that found out that you need to take the folate when you are in your first trimester of pregnancy.
Oh, I didn't know that. But she just is a significant voice.
Actually, like global, like globally finding yeah. out that like taking folate during pregnancy reduced like the instances of spina bifida. It was
Whoa,
huge.
Okay. And she's been one of the state government's most vocal critics. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, she's done a lot of work with Indigenous advocacy and organisations. I actually like know through the youth sector of her work in the youth sector. I think that that's how was my introduction to a lot of the advocacy work that she does in that space. She also did a lot of research in that space. So she's incredible yeah. and she's saying, get it together.
Yeah. All of this is horrible. Mm-hmm. It's really horrible because we know that confinement is harmful for anyone. And it would be especially detrimental to someone with additional support needs.
Yeah. And this unlawful and unjust treatment of juvenile detainees is what is currently subject to a class action in the federal court. This class action came in response to the death of Cleveland Dodd, who took his life in Unit 18 last year. Unit 18 is different from Bankshire Hill, like we were speaking about earlier. It is a repurposed unit for children detained in Casuarina Prison, which is a maximum security adult men's prison.
What was the class action doing?
Yeah, so it aims to compensate current and former detainees for the unlawful conditions and practices they were subjected to in juvenile detention.
Right.
It aimed to gain comprehensive reform to ensure youth justice is fit for purpose in WA. And it aims to realise the rehabilitative potential of detention through trauma-informed, culturally adaptive and or age-appropriate models of behavioural management. I think that what I would just add on to that part as well is when I was reading through what Fiona Stanley was saying was we have world-class scientists and youth workers and government officials. We have so many incredible people in WA. We really are primed and fit to build something really incredible and rehabilitative, and we have the community that could do this. Like, we have the
we have the tools.
Canvas there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
It just needs to be built and applied, and people need to be listened to. We just need to be focusing on it, really.
Right. So it seems like the expert advice is pretty unanimous, right? Yeah. All the people that know the most are saying what we should do.
Mm-hmm. When young people get the individual and nuanced help they need, they have better outcomes. The young people that end up in the system are vulnerable, often stuck in cycles of poverty, and have more support needs, which make them sometimes predisposed but never destined to offend. And I think that if we focused our resources on those earlier stages rather than when we're already in these systems and rehabilitating people from going through the system, we'd have different outcomes.
So
there are these sort of changes take generations often, and they're not going to happen overnight, but there are ways that they can be achieved over time. Raising the age of criminal responsibility, we've talked about.
Sure.
Reconsidering care to focus on more practical support and medical diagnoses and managing those. And there have been calls to move youth justice, such as Unit 18, out of the adult-focused corrective services arm of the Department of Justice as well.
Right.
The Commissioner for Children and Young People, Jacqueline McGowan-Jones, said if we keep funding the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, our children will continue to die. Mm-hmm. When we keep focusing here on the actual facilities themselves, we're funding the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff, and often we are funding ambulances, you know, like it's our healthcare system that's really feeling this. If we were funding early intervention engagement, if we were helping people before they got to these places and spaces,
considered and preventative. Yeah.
And also, if you check out any of the Productivity Commission reports, they'd all tell you it would actually be cheaper as well. It would be cheaper, people would be well adjusted. I remember going to an Invasion Day rally a few years ago, and there was an incredible woman speaking on stage, and I remember she said, our children are our future. And I was like, rock on. And then she said, when you take our children away, you're taking our future away. I remember feeling like a punch in the gut of like, our young people are our future, you know, doctors, mechanics, lawyers, cryptocurrency investors, nurses, all of this. We're going to really rely on them in 20 or 30 years, and we really need to be positioning ourselves to make sure that they're going to have great outcomes and great futures for them, for us, for each other, for a WA community. It's so important that we're investing in our young people so that they can invest in the next one and the next one and the next one. So.
Yeah. If you want to stay across this story, a place that we find really, really helpful and I find really useful for staying across what's going on in the youth sector, but also with updates and demands for what's happening with youth detention, Social Reinvestment WA is a great place to go. Their website or their Instagram, which is pretty well managed and really well and frequently updated with news and what's going on. They're a coalition body led by Aboriginal co-chairs. They're the non-profit sector and they're a human rights expert body. We've been working collectively, they've been working collectively for a more effective and connected approach to justice in Western Australia since back in 2014. They're pretty great, and you can check in with them on their Instagram or, over on their website. I find their updates to be nuanced and informed, and if not a little sort of impassioned, and I think that that's kind of important. to note when you're going into looking at this. They're not a news service, but they are an advocacy body and a support system. So checking in with them.
There are also people that know.
Exactly.
You know, it's hard to find anyone that's worked in these sectors that isn't passionate about it.
That's it for All Over It today. We got to say a big thank you to Katrina Tapp and Danielle Raphael, who produce and edit this podcast. If you want to check in with any of our episodes or give us a follow or a like on whatever platform it is that you're streaming, we'd love it. We'd love to hear it.
If you have any headlines that you're like, please make sense for this, because at the moment we're really running with things that our family and friends are like, hello, support us on this one.
Yeah.
What's this about? So if you have any questions where you want to know what it's about, or there's a story that you'd love to get into but you don't have ADHD and a bottle of Vyvanse to get deep into it, or a ridiculous university degree and a hex dead out your eyeballs, I'll do it for you. That's what it's all about.
We'll do it for you.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.